Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Tuesday, but feels like a Monday, January 21st, 2020. And in Washington, D.C., corporate Democrats are launching, I think, coordinated assaults on Bernie Sanders, the Democrat running for president. And this occurs as the impeachment trial of Donald Trump is officially underway as I speak to you. The Chief Justice gaveled them into session a few minutes after 1 p.m. Eastern time today. And we didn't really know how all this was going to play out until Mitch McConnell, the ruthless political operator and partisan hack who runs the U.S. Senate these days, revealed the schedule. And it is a real endurance contest for the senators who are expected to endure 12-hour sessions without being able to use a phone or a computer. They just have to sit there. They're not allowed to talk back or interject questions. And given the age of some of these people, a 12-hour session that starts at 1 p.m. is a real challenge. And likewise, for your humble host, this presents a challenge in trying to cover this. I can't stay home all day and binge watch, and then when it's over at 1 o'clock, post a podcast. So I'm going to do my best. I've got the DVR program to capture all of the proceedings, and I certainly won't be humanly capable of watching them all. So my current plan, since today's session is mostly on procedural issues, is to report on today's impeachment proceedings tomorrow. And then, of course, it's going to stack up over the weekend. And that's what Mitch McConnell wants. He wants information overload in a way that makes it inaccessible, that turns people off, and is no model for transparency and accountability in the process that is unraveling in Washington. And at the same time, the efforts by the Democrats to change the rules, to bring in witnesses before the end of the trial. I mean, the current plan is that each side gets 24 hours divided over 2 days. So two grueling 12-hour sessions, or up to 12 hours. And if the schedule goes according to plan, the Democrats might be able to present their case on Thursday and Friday, or maybe starting Wednesday and part of Thursday, I don't know. And then the Republican rebuttal will come over the weekend when nobody's watching. Perhaps that is the design. But there is a perverse factor that at least some of the proceedings will be in prime time in every time zone across the country. Will people tune out of reality shows to watch this arguably reality show? It's hard to say. So McConnell thinks that his rules are just fine and dandy. He has changed his language. He said he was going to use the same rules that were used in the Clinton impeachment proceeding. And now he says, well, that these rules mostly track with the Clinton rules. Democratic leader Chuck Schumer, he's upset because only the C-SPAN cameras will be permitted, at least as far as I know. And he's a guy who loves a camera. And I don't mean to diminish Schumer, because I think he is fighting an uphill battle to really promote a fair trial and one that is accessible to the American people. He called the Republicans' plan part of a cover-up and a national disgrace, and said he will move to amend the current rules resolution to mirror the one that was actually used during the Clinton impeachment. So it's clear that McConnell thinks they can rush this, that he has enough votes to keep his rules in place, and the way this will work is if witnesses and evidence are permitted, it will come after the 16 hours of questions by senators, which is supposed to happen early next week. Now, if somehow the Democrats prevail, and McConnell is forced to invite witnesses to admit either the evidence from the House record and or additional evidence that has surfaced, like the GAO report calling the president's withholding of aid to Ukraine a violation of the law. And if we get into witnesses, Mick Mulvaney, Lev Parnas, former White House counsel Don McGahn, those aren't even all on the list. The Democrats are only asking for four, which is a pretty weak bargaining position to start from. And polls show that the vast majority of Americans want witnesses, but many of those are Republicans who want Joe and Hunter Biden to be a part of this impeachment process. And so after the senators get their questions answered, then they will vote on whether witnesses and testimony, evidence, will be admissible. And it's possible that many of the Republicans who controlled the Senate may just decide, what do we need evidence and witnesses for? We're going to do what everybody has expected us to do from the get-go, and we are going to flush this as quickly as we can. Now, Democrats hope that the bad taste that's left behind by that will help them convert some Republican Senate seats to Democrat in the fall. But it will likely produce a claim of vindication by a president who I think is guilty of the alleged crimes and more. And who knows how that will play in divided America. Brian Schatz, the senator from Hawaii, a Democrat, is urging people to flood the Senate switchboard with calls demanding that senators allow new witnesses and evidence. And so let's take him up on that. I'm dialing 202-224-3121. I also want to ask for a secret ballot. As we discussed with Ron Fine in our podcast about impeachment released last Friday.
Thank you for calling the United States Capitol.
Oh, my
pleasure.
To be
connected to your senator's office, press or say 1. To be connected to your representative, press or say 2. Press or say 0. To continue to...
Let's see, I'm pressing 1. Do I get Harris or Feinstein?
You have reached the United States Senate. Please speak your state or enter your zip code.
California.
You have entered California. If this is correct, press or say 1. If not, press or say 1 for Senator Kamala Harris. Press or say 2 for Senator Dianne Feinstein. Press.
I wonder how Kamala got to
Hi,
be first.
Hi, this is Kamala Harris.
Hey, babe.
Thank you for calling my Senate office in Washington, D.C.
Yeah?
If you would like to leave a message to share your opinion about an issue, press 1. If you need general information about our office, press 2. If you would like to speak with a member of my staff, please press 3, and someone will be with you as soon as...
Let's see how quick they get on the line here. Talking to other
this
constituents.
This is Senator Kamala Harris. Thank
oh.
you for calling my Washington, D.C. office.
Well...
Because
I don't have time to hold on there, Senator. Anyway, you can follow my example. The reason I ask for a secret ballot is that it's an interesting strategy which would allow Republican senators to vote to remove the president, to vote for witnesses without becoming a Twitter target. The arguments from the dream team of hypocritical lawyers that Trump has assembled, including the hypocrite Alan Dershowitz, who said that you didn't require a crime to conduct the impeachment of Bill Clinton, but you do need a crime, you know, an ordinary crime, to pursue the impeachment of Trump. And then there's Ken Starr, who was president of Baylor and overlooked a sexual scandal on campus. He's an opportunist who drove the Clinton impeachment from Whitewater all the way through to Monica Lewinsky. But Trump likes these names that his TV viewers will recognize. So they're arguing that even if he did abuse his powers in an attempt to bully Ukraine into interfering in the election this year, it would not matter because the House never accused him of committing an ordinary crime. Now, this argument could have been prevented had they included the Michael Cohen crime, the cover-up hush money paid to the alleged mistresses of Donald Trump. So they trotted out Frank Bowman, the New York Times does, University of Missouri law professor. This argument is constitutional nonsense. The almost universal consensus has been that criminal conduct is not required for impeachment. And so, fundamentally, the Trump team attacks the process. They falsely claim that the hearings in the House were rigged, ignoring that the only extent to which they were rigged was that Trump didn't allow people to testify, didn't allow documents to be examined. And back in 1998, Alan Dershowitz said, "It certainly doesn't have to be a crime if you have somebody who completely corrupts the office of president and abuses trust and poses great danger to our liberty. We don't need a technical crime." In addition, the Trump brief confirms, This is the response from the House impeachment managers, the prosecution, if you will. Trump's brief confirms that his misconduct is indefensible. Trump's lengthy brief to the Senate is heavy on rhetoric and procedural grievances, but entirely lacks a legitimate defense of his misconduct. It is clear from his response that Trump would rather discuss anything other than what he actually did. Another quote from Senator Chuck Schumer, that this expedited timeline that McConnell has crammed on them will result in a rush trial with little evidence in the dark of night, literally in the dark of night. Schumer continued, "We are staring down an erosion of the sacred democratic principles for which our founders fought a bloody war of independence. McConnell rules seem to be designed by Trump for President Trump. It asks that the Senate rush through as fast as possible and makes getting evidence as hard as possible." Now, one of the other things is if the trial extends longer than McConnell has allowed, the February 4th State of the Union message, that is going to be a wild scene. Mitch McConnell reiterated his view that senators shouldn't decide about hearing witnesses and admitting documents till after they've heard opening arguments from the impeachment managers and Trump's lawyers and have had an opportunity to ask their questions. And if, as I mentioned, those who demand witnesses prevail, it will likely extend the trial quite a bit. One of the issues raised by the House impeachment managers is the role that White House counsel Pat Cipollone, or is it Cipollone, I don't know, is playing. Because as White House counsel, he was well aware of the Ukraine scheme. And we know that John Bolton sent Fiona Hill to the counsel's office to try to separate Bolton from these, sneaky proceedings and the Rudy Giuliani team. And it is amazing that when you look at the legal arguments that are being made, that the Republicans just blow right past the whole Rudy Giuliani thing, Lev Parnas and Igor Fruman serving as American ambassadors of threat and bully. And so it goes. Meanwhile, Trump has sallied forth to Davos, Switzerland, where he is basking in the oligarch love that he desperately seeks. They wouldn't give it to him before he became president. And it was more subdued than his mob rallies. He didn't chant "lock her up," but he made inflated claims about his role in the global economic recovery and the general scene here in the United States. And patted himself on the back without apparently injuring either arm. Every day I pause for a moment to thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast with your subscriptions. Great people like Joe Carson, Margaret Anderson, Susan Lewis, and Alice Carlson. I invite you to join their ranks. Just drop in at peterbcollins.com. You click on menu, then you click on become a subscriber, you hit the sign-up page, and in a couple of minutes you can choose a level of support that's comfortable for you. And if you don't like to use PayPal, You have options. You can correspond with me at my P.O. Box, number 150-660, San Rafael, California, 94915. Well, I reviewed, let's see, it was 17 different reports on the kerfuffle that started in the debate last week, actually before, when Elizabeth Warren has claimed that Bernie Sanders said that she couldn't win, and then he's being called a liar for denying that he ever said it. Well, yesterday, the major Democratic candidates were all in Columbia, South Carolina, for a march honoring Martin Luther King Jr. And the photo that's all over the place shows Bernie and Betsy arm in arm, locked, and Warren is next to Klobuchar, who is next to Biden, and it is this picture of unity. But behind that picture, the knives are out, they're being inserted and twisted. And I've tried to create a narrative here that you can follow between all these different attacks, which may or may not be coordinated, but it sure looks like it to me. So let's start with Paul Krugman. He got heavy exposure on the homepage of the New York Times today for one of those articles where the headline is not fully reflected in the body of the commentary. So the headline is really nasty. Biden, Sanders, Social Security, and smears. Lying about a rival is bad, even if you don't like his past positions. So there are two issues related to the Sanders campaign use of videos where Joe Biden is heard talking about cutting Social Security. Now, one of them is from 2018, and the argument is that Biden was mimicking or mocking Paul Ryan, who was his VP opponent in 2012, who and Ryan wanted to cut Social Security. Well, first they accused the Sanders campaign of doctoring the video. But it's not doctored. It may be out of context, and the context doesn't include that Biden was doing a send-up of Paul Ryan. But there are other videos that are out there that are older that are very clear that over a 20- or 30-year period, Joe Biden has frequently advocated for cutting Social Security. He offered it as a badge of his centrist leadership, that he could do something that would hurt his constituents. And the record of that is very clear. This piece from 2018, I will acknowledge, is less clear. But in the article, we have Paul Krugman first calling Sanders and his campaign Trumpian. Biden deserves an apology now, and Sanders probably needs to find better aides. This is no excuse for the Sanders camp. It would be good to have Biden explain why, in the more distant past, he went along with the Beltway consensus that Social Security needed to be pared back. And Krugman later acknowledges some of the complexity here. Biden did make a misstep, he says, in his counterattack, mislabeling the misrepresented video clip as doctored. But that doesn't mean he's not still due an abject apology. But the Sanders campaign has doubled down, Krugman says. Rather than admitting it smeared a rival, the campaign is going around claiming that Biden has a long record of trying to cut Social Security. And unfortunately, there is truth in that claim. But, says Judge Krugman, it doesn't excuse either the original lie or the refusal to admit error. So if you read the whole Krugman piece, it's fairly balanced. He says that Biden has advocated for Social Security cuts, but that this one from 2018 didn't reflect that. And in the end, he writes, I don't want to go overboard here. While there is a Trumpian feel to some of what we're seeing from the Sanders campaign, Bernie Sanders is no Donald Trump. There are some real issues with the people surrounding him, but they're nothing like Trump's gang of thugs. And in practice, a Sanders presidency like a Biden presidency would be a vast improvement, morally as well as substantively. So, the column, I think, was somewhat balanced, but the headline was not. And I've got another example of that coming up in a couple of minutes. So, Sanders did apologize to Joe Biden and the Biden campaign today for another issue. And this is an op-ed that was published on Monday, yesterday, in The Guardian, under the byline of Zephyr Teachout, who's fairly well known in New York State. She ran for attorney general. And I don't believe that Bernie has anything to apologize for here. But he did so, saying that Joe Biden is a friend of mine and I don't want to attack him. And what's interesting is, critics, it says here in the HuffPost article, notice the timing of the piece's publication the day before the Senate is scheduled to kick off its impeachment trial, which largely focuses on Trump's efforts to get Ukraine to investigate Biden. But Zephyr Teachout wasn't calling Biden corrupt for anything to do with Ukraine. There is no mention of the word Ukraine in her entire piece. Now, I've linked to her article, and you are free to read it for yourselves. What she says is, Biden has a big corruption problem, and it makes him a weak candidate. I know it seems crazy, but a lot of the voters we need, independents and people who might stay home, will look at Biden and Trump and say, they're all dirty. And again, this is a case where people don't click and read the article. They just confirm their bias from the brief headlines in social media. So Teachout's complaints about Biden are that he carried the bankruptcy bill. He's always been a supporter of his home state credit card industry. On April 25th, the day he announced his campaign, Biden went straight to a fundraiser co-hosted by the chief executive of a major health insurance company. And on climate change, Biden signed a pledge not to take money from the fossil fuel industry and then broke his promise. Those are her three complaints. And for that, she says he has a corruption problem. She didn't accuse him of a crime, just that he represents himself as the greatest fighter for the middle class, when he's actually selling the middle class down the river to please his corporate funders and friends. I think it's a very legitimate attack, if you will, based on issues from the Sanders campaign to the Biden campaign. So then comes Hillary Clinton. She taped an interview about a month ago where she just hammered Bernie Sanders. It is a four-part Hulu documentary called Hillary. And that's why the Hollywood Reporter had the scoop. They sent a reporter from the Hollywood Reporter to ask Hillary Clinton if comments that she made in 2016 about Sanders are still accurate. Quote, he was in Congress for years. He had one senator support him. Nobody likes him. Nobody wants to work with him. He got nothing done. He was a career politician. It's just all baloney, and I feel so bad that people got sucked into it. And asked if her assessment still stands, she says, yes, it does. So much for that unity photo from Columbia, South Carolina. Clinton also criticized the culture around Sanders, and she declined to say if she would endorse him if he becomes the Democratic nominee. Now, Bernie declined to go for tit for tat. When he was asked about this, he simply said, on a good day, my wife likes me. Now, this gratuitous attack by the discredited candidate who used the superdelegates and all of her accumulated influence, including the ability to intimidate people like Elizabeth Warren, who didn't want to offend the Clintons by endorsing Bernie Sanders in 2016. And they repeat the claim to fan the flames that have not been quelled since 2016, that Sanders had criticized her in the 2016 primary as being unqualified. That was a poor choice of word. But he was citing her vote for the war in Iraq, her fundraising methods, her support for trade agreements. And at the time, I counseled that he should have used the word disqualified. And, of course, Hillary Clinton had to attack the so-called Bernie bros. And she appeared to do so with relish. So there's quite a bit of comment on this. Let's first turn to Peter Dow and Leela Dow, husband and wife, who both worked on the Clinton campaigns going back to 2006. when she was gearing up to run for president the first time. And they write, "In the intervening years, we have very publicly reconsidered the single-minded intensity of our Clinton advocacy and apologize for exacerbating divisions between Clinton and Sanders voters. We have come to realize the extent to which the term Bernie bro marginalizes and erases the voices of millions of people of color and women who are part of the Sanders-inspired Not Me, Us movement." They go on. Here's the irony. "As we begin to embrace me, not us, and express support for Sanders, a cadre of Sanders haters began trolling and harassing us with the same venom that they attribute to the so-called Bernie bros. They impugned our motives and character, called us traitors and sellouts, mobbed our Twitter threads. It was a disconcerting awakening to the hypocrisy of those who slam Sanders supporters as a bunch of sexist young white males, then engage in identical behavior to those they criticize." The lesson, they say, is unmistakable. They're angry and obnoxious supporters of all candidates. And I will add that those who really took low blows against Elizabeth Warren don't reflect my views or my commentary. Later, they write, "For Clinton to come out rhetorical guns blazing against Sanders weeks before primary voting begins reflects misplaced priorities on the part of the Clinton camp and an unfortunate willingness to amplify destructive myths about Sanders and his supporters. Moreover, Clinton implies there's some equivalence between Sanders and Trump, saying we want hopefully to elect a president who's going to try to bring us together and not either turn a blind eye or actually reward the kind of insulting, attacking, demeaning, degrading behavior that we've seen from this current administration." I think that is powerful testimony. And over at BuzzFeed, they sent a reporter to New Hampshire who quotes a series of Bernie Sanders reporters essentially saying, this only hardens my support and doubles my intensity for trying to win for Bernie. Now, Sanders did make some comments to New Hampshire NPR on Sunday, I believe. And I have to say that the soundbite that comes out of it is unhelpful to Bernie. When you look at the full comment, it's not as bad. And before I read this, I just want to say that I defended Hillary Clinton in 2016 when she was hammered for the taken out of context quote about Trump's deplorable followers. Because when you read the full comment, she was actually compassionate about those people. Likewise, here is the full quote. "Everybody has their own sets of problems," Bernie said. When asked if he thinks gender is an obstacle for women running for office, he said, "Look, I'm 78 years of age. That's a problem. There are a lot of people who say, well, I like Bernie. He's a nice guy, but he's 78 years of age. So we have to argue. Please look at the totality of who I am." He went on, "If you're looking at Buttigieg, he's a young guy, and people have said, well, he's too young to be president. And you look at this one, and she's a woman. Everybody brings some negatives, if you like. I would just hope very much that the American people look at the totality of a candidate, not at their gender, sexuality, age, but at everything. Nobody is perfect. There ain't no perfect candidate out there." Like I said, the soundbite extracted from that is now weaponized and being used against the candidate himself. But when you look at the full context and, you know, have some empathy for what he was trying to say, I think it passes. Now, here comes another case where the headline, it does not reflect the full commentary in the article. This comes from the Liberal Nation magazine and its justice reporter, Ellie Mistal, who is a black male, by the way. The headline reads, "Unity requires recognizing that Warren is telling the truth." The subhead, "At the same time, tolerance must allow that Sanders isn't lying." And Ellie Mistal uses his feelings as proof of bias. And in the early going, he says that he believes Elizabeth Warren, quote, "I have no doubt she's telling the truth. I know in my soul that she heard what she says she heard. I know it, not because I'm in a position to vouch for Warren's character. I know it not because I have access to a Ouija board. I know it because I'm a black person, an other, and I've been living in a white man's world for 41 years and counting. People say hurtful things all the time. Often they don't mean it. Language is an imperfect tool. But when you're an other, when you're a minority or part of a disadvantaged group, you notice the hurts. You notice them because you always have to assess where the hateful comment lands on the spectrum between inelegant to actively dangerous. Now, he's entitled to his feelings, but they are no proof of who said what, and because nobody else was in the room. And it truly is one person against the other. But in his mild defense of Sanders, everything that Warren says happened tracks with my own experience of how one deals with these things. Warren says she disagreed in real time. Remember, folks, if you think Warren is lying, not only do you have to believe she made up something Sanders said whole cloth, you also have to believe that she made up her entire reaction to the event. Then he writes, Sanders straight up said that she didn't say it. The anger. The anger is very familiar to me. Well, let us allow that they had a conversation about the challenges a woman would face running against Trump. Maybe what Sanders said was interpreted by Warren that he was telling her she couldn't win. And Ellie goes on to say, I'm not surprised Warren didn't shake Sanders' hand. I'm surprised she didn't break it off and try to hit him with it. So then he goes on to write that after he apologized to his wife for a bad joke that was 24 years ago, he closes by saying, I'm not going to slam Bernie Sanders for getting his back up in the middle of a contested primary when the first ballots will be cast in a couple of weeks. Sanders has a solid record of supporting and promoting women candidates. That I care about. He also seems like a prickly pear. That I care less about. I'm not voting for a president based on their emotional intelligence unless Oprah gets in the race. But he's written this column based on his own so-called emotional intelligence. In the final here, I don't need for Bernie Sanders to remember every time he unintentionally, I believe, hurt someone's feelings. But I do need for Elizabeth Warren to be able to tell her truth and what I believe is the truth without people calling her a liar, a snake, or some hysterical witch who spends her downtime boiling up problems for men. Ellie Mistal, I'm sorry. You fail to acknowledge the timing of this and how she surfaced this through a leak at CNN that popped up in the debate. And I just reject the arguments he makes there. Then over the weekend, Joy Reid on MSDNC, she hit a new low. She called in a body language expert, a woman whose name is Driver, Janine Driver. And the expert concluded, oh, his shoulders come up like a little kid getting caught, adding that Sanders was trying to hide in plain sight. He starts with well. Liars like to start with well, she said. And Reid strongly agreed. Now, this is the same kind of bullshit theater that Rachel Maddow used in February of 2016 when she claimed that Bernie Bros threw chairs after the rigged caucus in Nevada. And Barbara Boxer was the manager of that caucus or moderator of it, and it was not a fair caucus. And when people exploded, they reported that somebody had thrown a chair. The fact is that one supporter had lifted a chair in the air and then put it down. Nobody made contact with it. It was not thrown. Nobody was injured. And Rachel Maddow didn't bring out a body language expert. She used footage from a World Wrestling Entertainment or World Wrestling Federation TV show where they brought in folding chairs for the wrestlers to throw at each other. This is so insulting. And I'll mention that Glenn Greenwald has been tracking Joy Reid and demanding an apology from her for her phony claim that Russian hackers inserted homophobic posts on her blog that were backdated. And speaking of Glenn, He is now being accused as being part of a criminal organization by the government of Brazil, the right-wing Bolsonaro government, and they are threatening, well, in fact, they have charged him with cybercrimes for his role in spreading cell phone messages that embarrass prosecutors and undermined their anti-corruption task force in the car war scandal in Brazil. Here's another piece for you to consider. It comes from a conservative columnist at the conservative Boston Herald. But this is their view of Elizabeth Warren. And the author here, Michael Graham, in part writes, Bernie Sanders isn't a liar, at least not outside the accepted parameters of American politics. He doesn't even lie about the stuff he should lie about, like his gazillion-dollar middle-class tax-hiking union health plan killing Medicare for all. Now compare Bernie's unvarnished truth-telling to Liz Warren's record. According to Warren's past statement, she's a Native American who was fired for being pregnant and only sent her children to public schools. And according to the facts, all of those claims are wrong. And he writes, Warren's campaign has devolved from I've got a plan for that to girls rule, boys drool. Over the summer, she was touting Medicare for All as a matter of political life or death. Tuesday night, she treated it like a recently dumped boyfriend, refusing to even say the phrase a single time. Warren is lying, he concludes, trashing Bernie as a desperate bid to get his women supporters to save her sinking campaign. Elizabeth Warren has only been in elected politics since 2012. She underperformed then. Obama got 60%. She got 53%. And in 2018, when she ran for re-election, she underperformed. I don't have the numbers on that. Now, this surprised me. Chris Cizilla, corporate pundit at CNN. He says he quotes Hillary's comments from the film and says, whoa, boy, tell us how you really feel, Hillary. The truth-telling by Clinton, this truth-telling will draw huge headlines. And that is very, very good news for Bernie Sanders, Saliza says. Sanders is running this 2020 campaign, as he did in 2016, on a simple premise. The powerful have been sitting comfortable for way too long, and it's time to shake things up. Sanders was vilifying the elites and the political establishment long before Trump even started considering running for president. This is who Sanders is. It's who he's always been. It's at the core of why people support him and why he's been able to build a movement around his back-to-back presidential candidates. Guess who? For lots and lots of Sanders supporters and even other Democrats who don't support him, epitomizes that elite establishment, the Clintons. Hillary Clinton, her friendliness with Wall Street, well-heeled donors always irk Sanders and his backers all the way back to 2016. For Clinton to attack Sanders as friendless and ineffective, and to do so with the Iowa caucus just 13 days away, affirms to Sanders' backers that everything he's been running against within the Democratic Party is still out there and still doesn't like him. That it is coming from Clinton, who not only represents the dynastic streak, within Democratic politics that many within the grassroots reject, but who also lost what everyone assumed was to be a sure thing victory over Trump in 2016, makes this even more powerful for Sanders. Oh, and here's in the stack where I get to the quotes from New Hampshire voters. No surprises here, so I'll save you a minute. Now, this is interesting. The New York Times disclosed in a Sunday article how Trump and his allies are trying to drive a wedge between Nancy Pelosi and the Sanders campaign. Like this sympathetic tweet from Trump on Friday. They are rigging the election again against Bernie Sanders, just like last time, only even more obviously. Crazy Nancy gives the strong edge to sleepy Joe Biden, and Bernie is shut out. They're referring to Pelosi delaying the delivery of the articles of impeachment until the trial ended up officially starting today, and Sanders and the others can't campaign in Iowa. Well, the talking point was repeated by Kevin McCarthy, the barely literate House Majority Leader, appearing on Fox. This is the dirty little secret nobody's talking about. This benefits Joe Biden. This harms Senator Sanders, who is in first place. Now, I admit this does block Bernie. He had planned to fly on a private jet to a campaign rally in Iowa on Wednesday night, and Mitch McConnell's scheduling past midnight will prevent that. But it also blocks Warren, Klobuchar, and Michael Bennett from Colorado, from doing any campaigning. So the coup de grace today is a column from Jennifer Rubin at the Washington Post. And in my view, she summarizes the swift boat attacks on Bernie Sanders. And I use swift boat intentionally. John Kerry was attacked by the swift boaters and Karl Rove using a dark money super PAC in 2004 on his strongest point, being a Vietnam veteran who came back and testified against the war. So Rubin writes, Hillary Clinton's searing put down of Bernie Sanders could not have come at a more opportune time for opponents, especially Elizabeth Warren. Then she quotes the comment about he has no friends, he got nothing done. The unqualified comment. Then she recites the claim that Sanders apologized to Joe Biden for the Zephyr Teach Out op-ed. Then there's the Social Security video doctoring comment. And Rubin writes, what is clear is that simmering anger among centrist and progressive Democrats over what they see as Sanders' two-faced approach to politics, holier than thou on his own good intentions while savaging opponents through mean-spirited surrogates, has boiled over. Then she revisits 2016 and says that his refusal to drop out of the 2016 primary long after it became obvious that he couldn't win drives continuing animosity. When, in my view, the real problem was the bias of the superdelegates who had committed to Hillary Clinton before Sanders even entered the race, and they never changed their position. So her closer is, if Sanders is feeling the heat now, it's only because his critics and competitors are sick of giving him a free pass to present himself as an honest, pure idealist while playing Trumpian politics. Did she talk to Paul Krugman? Put differently, two women, Warren and now Clinton, have had enough of his thinly disguised misogyny. So this is just a package of smears. Jennifer Rubin feels comfortable using the term misogyny, which defines Trump, to smear his potential opponent. And finally, on the Sanders attack, I want to commend you to a 20-plus page article by Kevin Gostola of Shadowproof. He published it at Medium. I've linked to it in the show file. And it's a list of bad faith arguments that have been used against Bernie Sanders with appropriate refuting commentary. And I'll leave that for you to read at your leisure. Along with this potentially orchestrated attack on Bernie Sanders comes the endorsement, the twin endorsements of Democratic primary candidates by the New York Times. And they go through a long process. They published an insert, a tabloid insert in the Sunday paper of about 20 or 30 pages, profiling each of the candidates and their appearances before the holy editorial board of the Times. And you've probably heard they give twin endorsements of Elizabeth Warren and Amy Klobuchar after dismissing Bernie Sanders. He has spent nearly four decades advocating revolutionary change for a nation whose politics often move with glacial slowness and the approval of the Times. Quoting again, a career spent adjacent to the Democratic Party but not a part of it has allowed him to level trenchant criticism of a political party that often caters more to rich donors than to the middle class. Are they dinging him for that? Many of his ideas that were once labeled radical are now mainstream and may attract voters who helped elect Trump in 2016. But he's too old, his heart attack, his approach to politics, compromise is anathema. And so 3 years into the Trump administration, we see little advantage to exchanging one overpromising, divisive figure in Washington with another. Yep, they want to tell us how to think and what the acceptable parameters are of our political thinking. I marked up their comments about Warren and about Amy Klobuchar, and given the length of this podcast already, I'll see if I have time to come back to this tomorrow. A couple of quickies. Here in California, there's good news out of Oakland. It was national news that the Moms for Housing occupied a vacant home that they had no right to, and they were brutally evicted by the sheriffs last week. Well, the good news is that there is an agreement that the house-flipping company will negotiate a sale with the Oakland Community Land Trust, and the moms may be permitted to live legally in the house that they were squatting in. I want to say farewell to Terrence Hallinan, a member of the Hallinan family. His brother Patrick, who I knew well, died recently. And K.O., as Terrence was known, died over the, it was on Friday at the age of 83. He had been a San Francisco supervisor, and then he became a district attorney for several years. He lost that seat to Kamala Harris. And his brother Pat told me when Terrence became the D.A., no Hallinan should ever be a prosecutor. And finally, I am perhaps America's lightest football fan, but even I couldn't resist watching the Santa Clara 49ers defeat the Green Bay Packers to head to the Super Bowl this year. The biggest question is, if they prevail in Miami, where will the victory parade be held? Because the San Francisco 49ers left San Francisco for their new Levi's Stadium, which is 40 miles away in Santa Clara. But they get to keep the San Francisco name for their brand, while they routinely screw the citizens of Santa Clara by shortchanging them on the agreements they made regarding building the stadium. Anyway, we'll see how all that plays out. Thanks for listening to this daily news and comment podcast. You're free to share it all over the place. You'll find it on YouTube. I'm Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.